My granddad poked his head into the room, gave me a quick grin.
"Hey, Lane,"
he said.
"Thought you might want to come with me out to the barn. See the animals?"
I'd never really been an animal person. We'd never owned so much as a goldfish back in New York. But since I was already awake, I figured I might as well join him. "Okay. Give me 5 minutes."
"Meet you in the kitchen,"
he said, closing the door softly behind him. I pulled on a pair of shorts and debated a tank top before finally deciding screw it. It was hot as hell already, and if Allegra and her big boobs could get away with it, I could too. My granddad chuckled when I walked into the kitchen, his eyes falling to my flip-flops.
"We're gonna have to get you some boots. Those aren't farm shoes."
He handed me a giant cinnamon roll wrapped in a paper towel and grabbed a mug of coffee from the counter.
"She makes better breakfasts than dinners,"
he said with a wink when he caught me sniffing experimentally at the roll. The air outside was just as thick at dawn as it was in the middle of the day, the only slight relief the lack of direct sun. Granddad slid open the big barn door, and we passed into the gloom of the barn, the air hazy with dust motes. A horse whinnied from a far stall in greeting, and a tangle of kittens rolled over my feet.
"Watch where you step,"
Granddad said, one hand loose on my elbow.
"Got these damn cats all over the place."
He pointed out each animal by name. 3 horses, 1 cow, too many cats to count.
"There's a half dozen dogs around, but they don't usually come into the barn unless it's snowing. Goats out back, and a chicken coop down the way."
I looked around, the horse in the stall behind me bumping his muzzle against my shoulder. Is this enough animals for a farm? I guess I always pictured more. Granddad laughed.
"Oh, hell, girl. These are all Allegra's pets. Things she got her heart set on, and I'm too much of a fool to say no."
He grabbed an apple from a bucket on the floor and held it, palm out to the horse behind me, who took it in his big yellow teeth.
"This ain't been a real working farm in years."
"What about the wheat?"
"That's just for fun. I like having something to do. Still like getting my hands dirty. But oil is what we actually harvest around here."
"Oil?" I pictured that old television show where the family struck oil in the backyard and ended up rich. It didn't sound as far-fetched now.
"Sure. My dad inherited this land, added to it over the years. More than 2,000 acres now, almost all of it fallow. He struck oil when I was young, and that's pretty much all she wrote."
The horse chomped down on my ponytail, and Granddad swatted him away.
"Your mama never told you any of this?"
"No. She didn't talk about you all much." Granddad sighed. His face sagged a little, like he'd taken a blow.
"Still miss that girl every day. Wish she hadn't taken off."
"Why did she?"
"Scared, I think, of having you when she was so young. Not even 17 when she lit out of here. But your gran and I would never have made her give you up or kicked her out. Hell, life is complicated. We know that. It wasn't anything to run away over."
He smiled.
"You better eat that cinnamon roll, then you can help me take care of these animals."
It didn't take long to feed all the animals in the barn, not with both of us working together. After, Granddad took me down to the chicken coop and showed me how to sneak my hand under the fat hens to grab their eggs. He laughed when I squealed the first time, the drift of feathers and the hot, smooth globe of fresh eggs so foreign in my hand. Charlie took the basket of eggs from me, and Granddad led me back to the barn, where we washed our hands in a cracked sink in the corner. He was already easy with me. Acted like this was something we'd done 1,000 times before instead of only this once. My social worker in New York. I trailed off, not entirely sure what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
He kept scrubbing his hands, not looking directly at me. She said I was lucky. She said you and Gran wanted me. Wanted me to come live here.
My granddad turned off the faucet with a wet hand, grabbed the towel I'd slung back on the hook nailed to the wall. Ah, sweetheart, he said. Of course we wanted you.
He hugged me, quick but warm, and I wasn't sure how to respond, my arms stiff at my sides.
I'm guessing your mama wasn't much of a hugger,
he said as he released me. I shrugged. She wasn't much of an anything. My granddad studied me, and I shifted uncomfortably under his gaze.
Sure sorry to hear that,
he said.
I'd hoped for better. For both of you. Our secret, but your mama was always my favorite.
He tweaked my ponytail.
But Lord Jesus, she gave me trouble. You gonna do the same?
His eyes twinkled under raised brows. I thought about it for a second. Maybe. Paused a beat. Probably. I waited for the fallout. But there wasn't any. Only another chuckle from my granddad.
All right, then. Guess that's fair warning.
As a little girl, I'd tried to please. Tried to live by the simple refrain my mother repeated like a desperate prayer in my ear. Be good. Be good. Be good. But I'd known even then it wouldn't work. Went against something dark inside me. A mean streak that came to the surface more often as I grew. And I thought maybe here, at Roanoke, my being bad wouldn't break anyone. I remembered Allegra's words last night at the dinner table about Emmeline, my granddad's sparkling eyes a moment ago when he spoke of my mother giving him hell. Maybe here it was like a different country, someplace where it was all right to be a little wicked.
Now, in the morning, my granddad is sitting on the kitchen table bench, bent over a mug of coffee. I pause in the doorway when I see him, take a second before he notices me. He's aged more than Gran, the gray at his temples spreading up and out. The hands curled around his coffee mug are knotted at the knuckles. He's in good shape, though, no bulge of belly or sagging biceps. The first word that springs to mind at the sight of him is still handsome. And when he glances up and sees me, his face folding into a smile, he could pass for a much younger man.
Ah, Laney girl,
he says.
Aren't you a sight for sore eyes?
It takes me a second to find my voice. Hi, Granddad. My heart turns over as I slide into a chair across from him.
Your gran told me you were home. So glad you came. I'm sorry I didn't track you down last night.
That's okay. I take a muffin from the platter in the middle of the table, break off a tiny piece. Blueberry juice stains my fingers. Tommy Kenning came by, said they haven't found anything new on Allegra. Granddad nods. He has hollows under his eyes, and he missed a patch of whiskers on his left cheek when he shaved.
Tommy's doing all right by us, keeping us informed.
What do you think happened? I ask, eyes on my hands. He doesn't answer for so long that I raise my gaze, surprised, to see tears hovering on his lashes.
I don't know,
he says finally.
She seemed fine. Not a thing wrong that I could tell.
He shakes his head.
I've gone over the day or two before she disappeared 1,000 times. Can't find anything out of the ordinary. She seemed fine,
he repeats. He's not an old man, only in his mid-60s. But he sounds like one now, lost and confused.
Well, you'd be the one to know.
I wait a beat, holding his eyes. I mean, assuming you were still screwing her. The house pulses around us, an awful, ticking silence. All the air sucked from my lungs, the room, the entire world. My heart is jackrabbiting in my chest, my palms and underarms slick with sweat. I have broken an unspoken rule. In this house, we talk around, not about. But I can't pretend anymore. At least not with him. Not inside these walls. My granddad cocks his head at me, his face slowly waking up, his gaze curious. Like I'm an intriguing new treasure he's anxious to get his hands on, crack open and sift through with eager fingers.
You always did promise to give me hell,
he says, the corners of his mouth curling into a grin. My own mouth responds in kind before I even know what's happening, and I bite down on the insides of my cheeks to stop the movement. That's all it takes. 2 seconds, and the lift of his lips, and he's managed to turn me into his co-conspirator. I realize that the distance I've put between us, both in miles and in years, matters not at all. Because behind the secrets and the horrible truth, under the shame and anger that beat like a heart, there still lives a terrible kind of love. We were talking about Allegra, I remind him, voice sharp. The smile fades from my granddad's face.
I love her,
he says.
If that's what you meant.
No, I say. That wasn't what I meant at all. I put the piece of muffin in my mouth. The sweet cake turns to sawdust on my tongue. I doze away most of the day, naked and sweating under my thin cotton sheet. The sun through the curtains casts filmy yellow shadows against the walls. It gives the illusion of being trapped in a moist, warm cocoon, and I feel drugged and fuzzy. My limbs still heavy with sleep, when I finally drag myself out of bed and get dressed. I splash my face with cold water in the bathroom, and I'm wandering back to my room when the phone on the hall table rings. No one else picks up, so I grab it, anxious for news of Allegra.
Roanoke residence.
Hey, Lane, it's me, Tommy.
I lean back against the wall, hit with sudden dizziness.
Allegra?
I ask.
Oh, no. No.
Tommy clears his throat.
Nothing new to report. Sorry.
It's okay. I blow out a slow breath.
What's up?
Listen, Sarah and I are going to Ronnie Joe's tonight for a drink. Wanna join us? Sarah's dying to see you again.
I wonder if the lie burns on his tongue. I'm pretty beat still from the drive. Maybe another time.
Come on, Lane. It'll get you out of the house. Get your mind off things.
He pauses.
Some other old friends might show up, too.
We both know exactly who he's talking about without either one of us having to say the name. I don't know, Tommy.
Oh, come on. It's just a couple of drinks.
I give in, only because I don't have the energy to argue, and an alcohol stupor is exactly what I need.
Okay, fine. When?
In a few hours. Around 8?
Yeah, sounds good. I'll see you then. The inside of Ronnie Joe's is about what I expected. But I can't suppress a flash of disappointment at the cheap plywood bar, the aging, girly calendar tacked to the wall, the slack faces poised over mugs of beer. When we were teenagers, we anticipated the day we'd be old enough to enter this tired brick building crouched at the end of Main Street, like a stray dog waiting to be kicked. As with so many things in life, the reality isn't worth the wait. The place doesn't exactly fall silent when I walk in, but there's a tightening of the air. My presence disturbs some delicate balance honed over years with no new faces making an appearance. The men sit higher on their bar stools, watching me from the corners of their bloodshot eyes. The women bristle. If they were cats, the fur along their spines would be standing on end. Allegra would have loved the reactions. She always thrived on this type of attention, the breathless satisfaction of being the biggest fish in a very small pond. They're sitting at a table near the back, under a glowing Bud Light sign, and Tommy motions me forward with his hand. The neon gives his skin a sickly green cast, highlighting the shadows beneath his eyes. The tall man across from Tommy keeps his back to me, doesn't turn around even after Tommy waves. I thread my way between the close-packed tables, whispers following me as I move. "Hey, Cooper," I say when I reach the table. My voice comes out desert dry. Cooper looks up at me, not bothering to straighten from his relaxed slouch, his spine melting into the wooden chair.
"Hey there, Elaine,"
he responds in his gravel, deep drawl.
"Long time no see."
His hair still falls into one eye, but it's darkened to the color of winter wheat. Just a few strands remain streaked with youthful gold. His body is as lean as ever, but the muscles in his arms are harder, veins standing out against his tan skin. A cigarette dangles negligently from the corner of his mouth, and when he plucks it out, I notice that he's never had his chipped front tooth repaired, a souvenir from a drunken fight. His golden brown eyes study me with plenty of fire, but very little warmth. He is still, after all these years, the most beautiful person I've ever seen. I gesture to the shot of whiskey in his hand. "Any more where that came from?" Cooper grins, and the dimple in his right cheek flares to life. He used to call that dimple his insurance policy. If all else failed, flash the cheek dent.
"There's always more liquor around here. It's the one thing we've got plenty of,"
he reminds me.
"Lane, glad you could make it,"
Tommy cuts in, formal in his nervousness.
"This is my wife, Sarah."
"Hi," I say, holding out my hand. Sarah takes it limply in hers, like I might be trying to pass her something unwanted in my palm. She is slight, overpowered by a mass of light brown curls she's tried to tame with a white fabric headband. She lives in the vast, overpopulated territory, somewhere between plain and cute, with the kind of face you can never fully recall afterward, every feature blurry around the edges.
"I'm sorry about your cousin," she says. "I'm sure everything will turn out fine."
"Well, that's reassuring," I say, pulling out a chair at the end of the table. Sarah's eyes drop away, her cheeks burning. Tommy gives me a warning look that I ignore.
"So,"
Cooper takes a lazy swallow of his drink.
"How have you been since you ran away from here?"
"I didn't run away."
"You didn't?"
Cooper raises his eyebrows.
"Could have fooled me."
He doesn't give me a chance to respond, scraping back his chair as he heads to the bar. Tommy, Sarah, and I sit in uncomfortable silence until Cooper returns moments later with a round of shots in his hands and an hourglass redhead by his side. When they sit, she positions herself under his arm, his hand dangling dangerously close to one plump breast. He doesn't introduce us. Are you the one who went to California?
The girl asks. She stinks of cheap perfume and bubblegum.
Yeah, that's me,
I say, downing my shot with grim determination. The whiskey hits my empty stomach with a hard thump, and sweat blooms along my hairline. My cheeks flush with heat.
What's it like?
I think of California, with its endless blue skies, sunny days, and perfect temperature. How the seasons bleed into one another with no way to mark their passing. The unearned bounty becomes a kind of narcotic, so that you wake up one morning and realize 10 years have come and gone, and you have nothing to show for it.
It's different. Cool. Different.
The girl gazes at me as if I've said something profound, and Cooper rolls his eyes.
I could have told you that much,
he says. I can't tell if he's more disgusted with her or me.
What do you do in California?
Sarah covers Tommy's hand with hers as she speaks. I must make her nervous, looking so much like Allegra, the one Tommy really wanted.
Whatever I can. Kind of hard to find jobs with only a GED.
I shrug. Waitress, cashier, receptionist.
Aren't those all code words for stripper?
Cooper asks. He gives me a sideways twist of his lips, a sly smirk full of bad intentions. This is the Cooper most people know, the one who hides behind snide comments and shit-eating grins. Once, I knew a different side of him, but I'm not surprised it's this version who's shown up tonight. Clever, I say, and give him my own tight smile in return. He blows smoke in my direction and I wave it away.
No one smokes anymore, I tell him.
He glances down at the smoldering cigarette between his fingers as if it begs to differ.
No one smart, I amend.
Well, you know us dumb hicks,
Cooper says, deepening his drawl.
Always behind the times. Thank God you're back so we can get caught up.
I open my mouth to respond, but the redhead cuts in, leaning across the table toward Tommy but looking at me.
Hey, I heard someone thought they saw Lane's cousin hitchhiking out on Lone Tree Road.
The whole table freezes, Tommy's gaze flying to mine.
Just a bunch of stupid kids spreading rumors, Lane. Looking for attention. But we checked it out, it was nothing. She wouldn't need to be hitchhiking,
Cooper says.
She had her own car.
Allegra did lots of things she didn't have to do, I remind him. Just for the hell of it? Tommy shakes his head.
No, it wasn't her. Remember Beth Van Horn?
He doesn't wait for me to nod.
It was her oldest girl. Somebody saw the long dark hair, jumped to conclusions.
The whole thing is totally tragic.
The redhead makes sad puppy dog eyes to prove her sincerity. She pauses to light a cigarette and I smirk at Cooper.
And like, no offense or anything since we don't know what happened to her yet.
She glances at me before continuing.
But what if we have a serial killer here?
She gives an exaggerated shudder.
It's like a horror movie. I swear, I can hardly sleep at night.
Tommy's eyes swing from Cooper to me and back again. He raises his eyebrows and Cooper shrugs.
One missing woman doesn't mean we have a serial killer at work,
Tommy says.
It sure could, the girl argues. Osage Flats' very own serial killer.
She makes it sound like a potential tourist draw. Hell, for all I know, maybe it would be.
Actually, that's the definition of serial,
Cooper informs her.
More than one.
The girl frowns, her head tilted to the side. What?
Never mind.
Cooper sighs, tapping ash from his cigarette into the already full ashtray. This whole town is completely fucked up. I mutter under my breath and catch the twitch of Cooper's mouth out of the corner of my eye. He rakes a hand through his hair, pushing it off his face in a gesture so familiar it makes my throat ache. His hands are bigger than I remember. And unlike in our youth, his fingernails are clean now, no half-moons of black. But the deep lines of his palms are still permanently stained dark with grease. Once I went to church with that grease smeared across my breasts. My skin hummed all day under my thin cotton bra. You still working at your dad's garage? I ask. It's a stupid question, but it's something to say that doesn't feel dangerous.
My garage, no.
Did your dad retire? I picture Mr. Sullivan, who always looked older than the other fathers, with his sloping shoulders and hard paunch of belly. I don't think I ever saw him smile.
Nope. Died. Last year.
How? Cooper plucks a piece of errant tobacco from his tongue.
Heart attack,
he says, voice mild like he's talking about the weather. Oh. Sorry, I say, because something seems required even if it's not heartfelt. Cooper nods, and for the first time all night he holds my gaze for longer than a moment. All the old, confused emotions tangle together in my gut, a heavy knot of pain. How's your sister? Is she still here in town? Cooper looks amused as he taps a fresh cigarette from his pack on the table. This type of small talk was never our area of expertise.
No. Holly's in Kansas City. She has been for years.
I heard you were in KC for a while.
For a while. Wasn't for me.
The redhead leans into our conversation. I'm getting us another round. Then maybe you can tell me more about California. She holds out her palm and Cooper fills it with cash, barely glancing in her direction. Looks like your date is more interested in me than you, I comment when she's out of earshot. Cooper grunts, his arm grazing mine as he drains the last of his drink.
No big loss. I've already been around that block one too many times. Checked out all the major landmarks.
Sarah leans over and swats Cooper's free hand. Don't be nasty.
Sorry,
he says. But I can tell he doesn't mean it. I lower my eyes and run my thumb in absent circles on the tabletop. Slowly, conversation starts up around me as the redhead returns with a bouquet of shot glasses. I drink mine with whiskey-numb lips, my gaze catching Cooper's as I swallow. A small, secret smile tugs at the corner of his mouth, telling me he's not fooled. He knows the truth. Knows little Lane Roanoke likes his brand of nasty just fine. Jane, born 1951, left Roanoke 1968. They were born on the same day, exactly 1 year apart. Him first, her after. Not twins, but they might as well have been. They were always treated like a set. Yates and Jane. Jane and Yates. Always a they, a we, never two separate people. Sophia came 5 years after Jane. She was an afterthought to more than their parents. All Jane really remembered of Sophia's childhood was her high, pleading voice. Wait for me. They never did. Sometimes Jane tried to pinpoint when it started, but there wasn't a single moment she could look at and say, there, right there was the beginning. By the time he kissed her, it was already done. That kiss felt like the 1,000th step, not the first. She thought maybe it started from the time they were born. The two of them and 2,000 acres. All that childhood curiosity combined with all that isolation. There was no one else for them to play with, talk to, fixate on. And even if there had been, would it have mattered? Would any other boy have been as handsome as Yates? Would any other boy have looked at her like every word out of her mouth was gold, like every move she made hung the moon? She was 14 the first time they had sex, in the hayloft in the barn, hot and sweaty, and neither of them feeling any shame. It felt like a natural progression of all the things they'd done before, catching frogs and riding horses, laughing on the sleeping porch after dark, sharing ice cream on sticky summer days, whispering secret dreams for the future, kissing behind the barn, his warm hand under her blouse. Yates and Jane, always together. She wasn't even sure if she loved him, as much as they were fused. Like, he was an extra appendage, a part of her that could never be severed. A single heart beating between them. The two of them lived in a bubble of their own making. Other people might see the dark edges, but they saw only the gilded center. But then, Jane got pregnant. And something inside her grew along with the baby. The idea that she wanted more than this farm, this endless blue sky and flat horizon. The idea that maybe there was something beyond this place. But she didn't even have to ask to know he would never leave. He loved Roanoke. If Jane owned half of Yates's heart, Roanoke held the other half, and it was never letting go. But the truth was, Jane didn't think she owned her half outright anymore. Because Yates loved Sophia now, too. Not the same way he loved Jane. Not yet. But she could see it whenever Sophia walked into the room, the way Yates's eyes sparked, a little flash of heat. Jane stayed until the baby was born, though. Suffered through their mother's thin, pinched lips when her eyes fell on Jane's growing belly. Endured their father's nightly dinner table sermons about sin and hellfire. Yates held her hand during labor, cradled their daughter's tiny body in his still teenage arms. Jane let him name her Penelope. It wasn't a name Jane would have chosen, but she wouldn't be the baby's mother for long, so it didn't matter. She left in the night, without a note or a goodbye, her body still bleeding from Penelope's birth. If given the chance, he probably could have convinced her to stay. So she made a clean break, ran down the driveway, and hitchhiked her way south. No more Yates and Jane. Just Jane. And she was free. Then. In the few days I'd been at Roanoke, my gran had been more of a passing presence than a permanent fixture. She swept past me in the hall, admonished me to put on sunscreen when I was out by the barn, snapped her fingers at Allegra and reminded her to clean up her mess in the kitchen. A directive Allegra ignored. But beyond those quick interactions and nightly dinner in the dining room, I'd seen her hardly at all. So it took me by surprise when I found her sitting on my bed, a pile of fresh laundry stacked next to her. "Come in, Lane," she said with a clipped smile when I hesitated in the doorway. "I want to talk to you." She patted a spot on the bed and I sat, curling my feet up underneath me, the laundry between us. Once she had me where she wanted me, Gran straightened the seam of her pant leg, plucking away invisible lint.
"Lord, it's hot in here. We can get you a window unit. The fan isn't much help."
It's okay. I kind of like having the windows open. In New York, when we'd open the windows, it had smelled of exhaust and stale Chinese food from the restaurant below us. Here, the air was fresh and hot and green.
You and Allegra. I don't know how you girls stand it.
She fanned her face briefly.
Anyway, I wanted to ask you about your mother.
Oh. I'd known at some point one of them would want more details about my mom and our life, but I'd figured it would be my granddad. It wasn't that it was difficult for me to talk about my mother, more that I had nothing to say, nothing anyone in their right mind would want to hear.
I know it probably seems impossible to you because she was your mother. But she was my little girl, once,
Gran said. Her voice remained steady, her eyes dry, for which I was thankful.
I was only 20 when she was born. 19 when I had my first one, Eleanor. Not as young as Camilla was when she had you, but still mostly a child myself.
You and Grandad got married young. Gran smiled.
Very young. I was 18. He was only a year older. Oh, my family threw a fit.
She slapped her leg with one hand in emphasis.
We were in St. Louis visiting my mother's aunt, and I saw your granddad across the lobby of our hotel. Knew right then and there I had to have him.
She laughed, leaned her head toward me.
I was a willful thing, at least when it came to Yates.
Did you move here right after you got married? Gran nodded.
It took some getting used to. After Boston, all this space, all this... nothing.
Her voice drifted off and her eyes followed. It took her a few seconds to find her way back to the story.
But I had Penelope to look after. Your granddad's niece.
Allegra told me about her. She said you and granddad raised her?
Yes, we did. Until her accident. She wasn't even a year old when we got married. Our own started coming right after. Sophia, your granddad's youngest sister, was here to help me. At least until...
Allegra said she drowned.
Well, Allegra's certainly been filling you in on the family history.
Gran smoothed a strand of hair off her face, tucked it into her tidy chignon.
I'm sure you know, then, that your mother ran away before you were born. We never knew much about what happened to either of you after that. Your mother didn't make it easy for us to keep in touch. And eventually we gave up trying.
Gran sighed.
I always wondered about her, though. About how she turned out. Was she a good mother?
Gran touched the back of my hand with one manicured fingernail.
No, I said.
Not really.
Gran nodded, like that was the answer she expected.
Were you close?
I had no idea how to answer her question. How could I be close to someone who barely spoke to me? Someone who I strongly suspected hated me more than she loved me. But at the same time, my mother was as much a part of me as my blood or my skin. Sometimes I swore I felt her vibrating through my bones.
I don't know, I said finally. She was my mother.
Tell me something about her,
Gran said, twisting toward me. It was the most interest she'd shown in me since my arrival.
Your strongest memory.
I scrolled back through images of my mother, almost all of them tear-stained. She was sad, I said. She cried a lot. Gran closed her eyes for a moment, gave my hand a quick pat before opening them again.
Is there anything you want to ask me?
About your mother.
She voiced the question reluctantly, like she owed me a debt she wasn't sure she knew how to pay. I scooted closer on the bed. Gran put her hand on the laundry to keep it from toppling over, or maybe to keep a barrier between us. Actually, I wondered about my father.
What about him?
She never talked about him. Do you know who he is? If he still lives in Osage Flats? Did she tell you his name? I leaned toward Gran, my words spilling out of me.
Lane, Gran sighed. He could have been anyone. Anyone. Your mother wasn't exactly discerning.
Oh. My shoulders sagged even as I resisted the urge to pound my fists against the bed. My mother had dragged my father along with her to the grave. One more in a long line of answers she'd denied me. Gran stood.
Get this laundry put away, why don't you, before Sharon takes exception.
Once she was gone, I flopped back on the bed, let my laundry unspool around me. I'd lied to Gran. Not about my mother crying all the time, that part was true. But my most vivid memory of my mother was one I would never share willingly. It wasn't the type of recollection to be passed around, touched, and fawned over. We'd been lying on her bed in our apartment, on our sides, facing each other. I was 10. She was tracing my face with her fingertips, and I remember being happy. Happy she was paying attention to me, focusing solely on me without tears or trepidation. Right now, she whispered. You look exactly like your father. I loved him so much. I thought maybe she was finally going to tell me some detail about him, but before I could ask a single question, her hand trailed lower, around my neck. She squeezed. Gently at first, so that I didn't wrench away as fast as I should have. Then harder, her nails digging into my skin. It makes me want to hurt you, she said, voice calm and eyes wild. By the time I broke away, two of her fingernails had pierced my skin, blood pearls set in a necklace of bruises. Later, when she locked herself in her room, weeping and pulling at her hair, I stood in front of the bathroom mirror and tried again and again to recreate the look on my face in the moment before she'd hurt me. Tried to find the expression that reminded her of my father. But no matter how I contorted my features, only my mother's face stared back at me.
Get your ass out of bed, Allegra yelled, slapping at my legs with both hands. What are you doing anyway?
I rolled over onto my back and covered my face with a pillow. Taking a nap. Don't people nap in Kansas?
Not when there's stuff to do,
Allegra said, yanking the pillow off me and tossing it to the floor. She peered into my face.
Are you, like, depressed or something about your mom?
I shook my head. No, not really. And it was true. I didn't miss my mother the way I should have. Her death felt more like relief than sorrow. She had slipped away into oblivion, where she'd wanted to be all along. We were finally free of each other.
Then come on, Allegra said.
She pulled me up by one arm. Where are we going?
Into town.
Allegra frowned at me.
Is that what you're wearing?
I glanced down at my cut-off shorts and plain t-shirt.
Yeah? Isn't Osage Flats, like, 10 miles away?
I looked out at the cut glass sky, not a single cloud in sight.
We're going to get heatstroke walking that far.
We're not walking,
Allegra said.
Hurry up!
I slipped my feet into a pair of flip-flops and stood still while Allegra tied my t-shirt into a knot at my waist, ran her hands through my sleep-tumbled hair.
Perfect, she said. You look freshly fucked. Here, put this on.
She handed me a tube of lip gloss. It left my lips tacky and tasting of strawberry.
We need to get you some better clothes, she said as she skipped down the main staircase. Everything you have is like bargain basement crap.
I wasn't offended. My clothes were crap. I don't have any money, I told her. My mom wasn't exactly rolling in it.
You don't need money.
She grabbed my hand and pulled me down the front hall and through a series of rooms I was still learning my way around.
Quick detour, she said over her shoulder.
She stopped in the office, in front of our granddad's large cherrywood desk. She opened the top left-hand drawer and pointed at a black zippered envelope.
Credit cards. Get on the computer, buy what you want. That's what they're for.
I hesitated. But only for emergencies, right? Allegra snorted.
Sure. If you consider an urgent need for a dozen crop tops an emergency.
Is there a limit? I mean, I can't order whatever I want. Can I?
I don't see why not. I do.
Allegra bumped my hip with hers.
Seriously, Lane, that's why Granddad leaves them there. For me. For us.
She glanced down at her phone.
Oh, shit. Come on, we're late.
We race-walked down the drive, Allegra urging me to hurry up.
But don't run. We don't want to be all sweaty.
What the hell are we doing? I asked. Despite her warning, beads of sweat were already trickling down my back. There was no wind today, the air stagnant and wet against my skin.
Getting a ride, Allegra said.
She stopped where the driveway intersected with Route 24.
They'll be here soon.
She gathered her hair into a messy knot on top of her head. Her giant gold hoop earrings flashed in the sun when she turned to me.
How do I look?
Gorgeous, I told her honestly, and she smiled. Who are we getting a ride from?
You'll see.
I looked behind me at Roanoke. When strangers drove past and saw it in the distance, they probably thought it was an insane asylum. The idea made me smile. To me, it looked like a ship, strong and unsinkable, afloat on a wild sea of wheat. Allegra pinched my forearm.
Here they come.
A small silver car crested the rise to the north. Allegra waved, and the driver gave a quick tap on the horn. The car pulled into the driveway and stopped beside us, kicking up a tornado of dust which left me coughing.
Hey, handsome,
Allegra said, leaning into the driver's side window. A teenage boy with dark hair smiled back at her. He looked out of place in the tiny car, his broad shoulders spanning the width of the driver's seat.
Hi, pretty girl. Need a ride? He said.
From the interior of the car, someone muttered.
Oh, for God's sake.
And I turned my face away to hide my smile.
Lane, get over here,
Allegra said.
This is Tommy Kenning.
Hi, I said, giving him a brief wave. His eyes sparkled as he grinned at me.
Hi, I've heard a lot about you.
He hooked a thumb toward the passenger seat.
And this is Cooper Sullivan.
I bent down a little to see into the car. The boy in the passenger seat glanced over at me, his blonde hair blocking one eye. He raised a single finger off the open window frame in greeting.
Get in the back, Cooper, Allegra demanded. I want to sit up front.
Fuck off,
Cooper said.
You wanted a ride. You get in the back.
I tried to pull open the passenger door on the driver's side, but it wouldn't budge.
Sorry,
Tommy said, craning his neck toward me.
That door doesn't open. You have to go around.
Are you and Tommy dating? I whispered to Allegra as we skirted the back of the car.
Kind of.
Her grin was smug.
He's totally in love with me.
How old are they? I asked, not worried, just curious.
18. They graduated a few weeks ago.
She opened the car door and mouthed, "An older man," at me, before collapsing into giggles in the back seat. I couldn't help but laugh.
Scoot over, crazy girl,
I told her, prodding her with my knee.
So, you been into town yet?
Tommy called back to me once we were on the road.
No, this is my first trip.
I hope you're a fan of disappointment,
Cooper drawled. I caught his eye in the side-view mirror, and a fever blush spread across my cheeks. But I didn't look away, made sure Cooper dropped his gaze first, a little smirk dancing on his face. We parked at the end of Main Street, Tommy's car one of the only vehicles on the entire stretch of road. "Where is everybody?" I asked as we all climbed out of the car.
"Who knows?"
Cooper said.
"Probably in their trailers, cooking up meth."
This is the downtown? I couldn't believe a place so quiet and empty could be the center of town.
"Uptown," Allegra said. "We call it Uptown. Like, get me some milk when you go uptown."
From what I could tell, Uptown consisted solely of a collection of ragtag stores, a small grocery, a walk-up hamburger stand, a second-hand clothing store, and a five-and-dime with strips of faded flypaper hanging in the windows. The majority of the storefronts we sauntered past were empty, faded for lease signs propped in dust-streaked windows.
"Down there is Ronnie Joe's," Tommy said,
pointing to the far end of Main, two blocks in the distance.
"Local bar," he said in response to my questioning look. "And across from it is the Eat."
"Our version of a fine dining establishment,"
Cooper said.
"Where you go when you really want to impress the ladies."
Somehow we'd ended up walking two by two, Tommy and Allegra holding hands in front, Cooper and I behind, a careful wedge of space between us. The sidewalk shimmered under the relentless prairie sun, and we all gravitated to the thin strips of shade the store awnings provided.
"And that's Cooper's dad's gas station," Allegra said. "Down past the Eat. Last thing you pass on your way out of town."
Allegra let go of Tommy's hand and turned, walking backward.
"Maybe someday, if you're really, really lucky, it will be all yours, Cooper."
I glanced at Cooper, expecting anger, but he only continued to tap a cigarette from the pack he'd pulled from his back pocket.
"Maybe,"
he said, flipping the cigarette between his lips.
"We can't all be little rich girls."
"Oh, screw you,"
Allegra said, whirling back around. She grabbed Tommy's hand and pulled him forward, away from us. Cooper grinned around his cigarette and held out the pack to me.
"Want one?"
I used to smoke sometimes back in New York, huddled in alleyways with girls from school who were never my friends but pretended to be.
"Sure,"
I said. Cooper cupped his hand around the cigarette to light it while I held it to my mouth. His hand brushing against mine sent sparks cascading into my belly, and I sucked in too fast, choking on the smoke.
"Easy," he said, amused. "You inhale the smoke, not the whole cigarette."
I glared at him and he laughed, a dimple appearing in his right cheek. I wondered what it would feel like to rest the tip of my finger inside it.
"Come on, you slowpokes," Allegra yelled from the corner. "I want to show you something, Lane."
When we rounded the corner and caught up with Allegra and Tommy, they were standing in front of a dilapidated old house with a familiar-looking turret on one side.
"This is what Gran modeled the brick addition on," Allegra said.
She was hanging onto the chain-link fence surrounding the house, her fingers and toes hooked through the metal, sandals abandoned on the sidewalk. Signs were posted along the fence warning people to keep out. The house looked like a strong wind would topple it, send it crashing into a pile of matchsticks.
"Isn't it cool?"
Allegra said. I looked at the boarded-up windows, the sagging front porch, the patches of rotted wood, not sure what to say. If Roanoke was an insane asylum, this place was a haunted house, vengeful ghosts lingering in all the shadows.
"No one's lived here for years," Allegra continued. "Not since, like, 1960.
1970,
Cooper corrected.
"Whatever. Anyway, the lady who owned it was called Madame Wright. She was a loon."
Allegra kept her eyes on the house as she talked.
"She gave illegal abortions in her basement."
"I don't think that's true," Tommy said.
"It's true," Allegra said. "Granddad told me they found tons of teeny tiny baby bones in her backyard well after she died."
Allegra glanced back at me, smiled.
"Too bad she was before your mom's time, Lane. We could have gone digging for the bones of your brothers and sisters."
"Jesus Christ," Cooper said. "What the fuck is wrong with you?"
It took me a minute to understand what Allegra was saying, my brain sifting the words until they made sense. "She was only 16 when I was born," I said finally.
"So?"
Allegra said.
"Just because you were her last doesn't mean you were her first. You were just the only one she didn't have yanked out and thrown away."
Allegra turned and looked at me. Her face fell.
"Oh, don't be upset, Lane," she pleaded, hopping down from the fence to fold both my hands between her own. "It's not like my mom wasn't knocked up a bunch of times, too. The Roanoke girls are fertile."
Her smile was all glee and excitement.
"We get pregnant every time we spread our legs."
"Better be careful there, Tommy," Cooper said.
"Shut up,"
Tommy muttered, his eyes downcast and his neck flushed red. Now, I wake with a pounding headache, my tongue whiskey thick and stuck to the roof of my mouth. I may be in a different state, but the outlines of my life are depressingly familiar. It's only late morning, but the sun already roars in through the sheer curtains, making me realize how gentle the sunshine was in California. There, it bathes you. Here, it smacks you across the face. I heave myself upright with a muffled groan and swing my legs out of bed. The floor underneath my left foot feels uneven, and I glance down, find Allegra and Lane gouged into the wood. I rub the message with my big toe, remembering the morning Allegra carved it there, still in her nightgown, one of Sharon's strawberry muffins clasped in her free hand. The memory gives me an idea, and I shift back onto the bed and grab my phone from the nightstand, look up the number of the police department. The receptionist puts me straight through to Tommy, who answers around a mouthful of food.
"Oh, hey, Lane,"
he says once I identify myself.
"How are you feeling this morning?"
"I've been better," he chuckles.
"One shot too many?"
Or maybe three too many, but that's not information I need to share with Tommy.
"Listen," I say, "do you remember how Allegra used to carve words into things, and sometimes little pictures?"
Tommy doesn't respond, and I forge ahead.
"Like,